Good morning. I'm Barry Sutton from Princeton, and I'm your convener today. I'm here to remind you to fill out the evaluation form when you're done. If you haven't done it yet, it's very easy. If you go to your itinerary, click on the session, there's a link to evaluate this session. Very easy, a couple of check boxes and a place to put in some text. So today, your speakers are Shirley Payne from the University of Virginia and David Escalante from Boston College. Shirley is the Assistant Vice President for Information Security Policy and Records. She works in partnership with units and individuals across the university to formulate policies, assess security risks, establish strategic direction, provide security education and training, implement security safeguards, and on and on. She's basically, I guess, the security guru at UVA. She's had many years of experience in higher ed also, and she misses her puppy. David is the Director of Computer Policy and Security at Boston College, and he is responsible for all data security matters. He was nominated for the Information Security Executive of the Year in 2005 and 2006. And in prior life before Boston College, he consulted with a variety of Fortune 500 companies on network and security issues. He recently went to New York and saw the Addams Family, which he thought was okay, but he really enjoyed Nathan Lane. Anyway, so here are your speakers today.
Thank you. What we're going to do here is sort of have a split discussion where I'm going to go over general things to consider when you're dealing with a third-party service provider, and then Shirley's going to provide specifics about what the University of Virginia did. So I'll talk sort of about meta-process things you might want to do, and then she'll actually get into institutional-specific things when the rubber hits the road. So what I'm going to talk specifically about is why you would want to worry about doing some sort of a risk assessment of a third party. Talk briefly about SAS 70, because that word always appears when you deal with third parties, and how you might want to approach it. And then talk a little bit about an approach that the Higher Ed Information Security Council has decided is probably the right way to go, called shared assessments. And then Shirley will talk about the UVA issues. You've all probably seen horror stories of lost records and things like that, but a lot of lost records actually end up being lost via contractors and third parties and things like that. They aren't just employees losing them or hackers stealing them. And when people talk about the cloud, and no, we do not have the standard cloud slide with cloud architectures and things like that in here, and there's a concern about things. One of the top concerns is always security and should we put things out in the cloud. And essentially, if you're giving your information to somebody else, they may or may not manage the information better than you. It could be that a cloud provider is going to do a better job than you would, but you just don't know. And how do you get a sense of that? How do you figure that out? That's what we're going to be talking about. When you're going to give your information to a third party, you want to sort of look at it from two different perspectives. One is a contractual perspective, and the other is from an assessment perspective, and those are actually two separate things. So you can sign a contract with somebody that says, if you lose my data, it's your fault, and you're going to bear the liability and things like that, but that might not save you at all from having your name on the front page of the paper. So if you perceive the distinction, you can sign a contract that gets you out of liability, but it doesn't get you out of reputational issues. So it's still important to do an assessment for reputational purposes. And I'm going to focus on the assessment side of things here. On the contractual side of things, EDUCAUSE has actually done a couple of things. Well, higher ed has done a couple of things. The National Association of College and University Attorneys has prepared some templates that you would want to use if you were dealing with a third party. And EDUCAUSE has prepared about a 30-page document with excerpts from various contracts that take different approaches and flavors to what you would want to do when you're dealing with a third party. So there are links to those at the end of the presentation. And having said that, we're going to sort of leave the lawyering aside because neither Shirley nor I is a lawyer. So what we do want to talk about is, from an assessment perspective, figuring out what your risk is going with a third-party provider before you give your data to them. How might you approach this? There are a bunch of different ways you can do it. One is you can make it up, and there are people who have done that. Some of the large research universities have made up their own approaches for evaluating third parties. Or if somebody's outsourcing something particularly important, they'll hire a contractor and have them help with the RFP. Or they'll borrow something from a colleague at another institution. There's a group that gets a lot of well-deserved press called the Cloud Security Alliance. And they've done a lot of work around security issues with outsourcing of data. And there's a group called Shared Assessments that I'm going to talk about more in a few minutes. And there are also general security frameworks from various places. The government has them. There's one called, there's an ISO standard. There's one called COBIT that's more accounting-based. So there are a variety of ways you can do this, basically, is what I'm saying. And the two we're going to spend time talking about today are SAS 70 and shared assessments. And I want to mention SAS 70 just because there are a couple of issues with it. One is SAS 70 is an accounting standard that people have false impressions of. So just want to take a minute and talk about what SAS 70 actually is if you're not familiar with it. And the other is that despite the fact that SAS 70 is a popular buzzword, it's been replaced. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the replacement. So if you run into that buzzword too, you'll have a sense of what's going on, because it's a bit of a surprise if you ask for SAS 70 and people say we don't do that anymore. So SAS 70 was essentially designed as an auditor-to-auditor communication where if there were two entities that one took over part of a business process for another entity, you could have your auditor certify that you were doing the business process properly and correctly such that the auditors at the other place could say, oh yeah, that part's been audited and it's sort of incorporated into our business process by reference because we outsourced it to them, but they're not doing it in a bad way and we don't have to go off and do an independent audit. So SAS 70 is an auditor-to-auditor communication that just says that some process is acceptable from an audit perspective. The process is actually defined by the person who is asking for a SAS 70 to be done. So I'll give you an example of why this is potentially an issue. Boston College was outsourcing some fairly sensitive records in the last couple of years, and we asked if there was a SAS 70 had been done of this company's processes, and they said yes. And we asked to see the SAS 70 because you basically, a SAS 70 is like, test me on something where I make up the questions, right? And make sure I got the right answers. And it turned out that they wrote that they weren't responsible at all for protecting the data. They didn't put locks on the doors. They didn't do this. They didn't do that. They just made sure the computer was running and that the software was available and things like that. And that's fair because SAS 70 allows you to say that. And when they were evaluated and passed on the SAS 70, they weren't evaluated on any security elements. So that was of interest to us because we then had to do other things. So don't believe it if anybody tells you they're SAS 70 certified, and don't believe it if anybody tells you they have a SAS 70, because it's good to know that they have been certified, but you need to know what the certification actually involves. SAS 70 also, as I said, has been replaced by a couple of new standards. The main one that you'll probably see in the U.S. is called SASE 16, and it's based on an international standard, which I can't pronounce, but which is up on the slides there. I don't want to get Shirley's. So SASE 16 is the replacement for SAS 70. And you might think that as a replacement for SAS 70, given that SAS 70 has some issues, it would fix some of those issues. But SAS 70 was invented, as I said, by accountants for accountants. And the new one was produced by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. So again, it's dealing with the whole thing from an accounting perspective and an auditing perspective and not from an IT security perspective. Essentially, what you get in SAS and SASE 16 is there are three flavors of SASE 16 reports, whereas in SAS 70 there was a Type 1 and a Type 2, and they still keep the Type 1 and Type 2. So now you've got six different things instead of two different things. In real life, when I've been talking about SAS 70s being auditor-to-auditor communications, they've defined in SASE 16 that type 2 is the auditor-to-auditor communication, and type 3 is the thing if you want to make something available to customers or prospective clients or the public or something. So if you're looking for a SASE 16 report, you're probably going to be looking for a type 3 or a SOC 3, whether it's type 1 or 2. Type 1 isn't as rigorous as type 2, so the best you're probably going to get out of a SASE 16 would be a SOC 3 type 2. And that actually is certified if you get a SOC 3. And you get a lovely little certification type thing, which you can see on the slide there. So retreating from SAS 70 and talking about, again, how to approach the whole risk thing, supposing you want to ask your own questions as opposed to just accepting the questions that they defined, like how do you approach this, how do you approach that, do you vet your employees before you hire them, do you cut off their accounts when you fire them, are your doors locked, all the sort of standard security questions without even getting into the technical things. You can build your own, you can adapt somebody else's, whether it's another higher education institution's or somebody else's, or you can adopt someone else's approach wholesale. The quickest way to get started, if you don't have any set of questions that you want to ask or anything like that, is to just adopt somebody else's set of questions wholesale. If you already have a set of questions or you already have an idea of what you're trying to do, if you can pull in somebody else's questions to give yourself sort of a solid base and then fold your questions in from an adaptation point of view, that's beneficial as well. And shared assessments is the tool that we think is probably the best way to approach adaptation or adoption. So what is shared assessments? Shared assessments is a program that was built out of a financial industry consortium called BITS. And it's been around for a long time, probably about 10 years now. And if you take a look at the slide, you can see that there are a bunch of really high-profile companies that were involved in the production of shared assessments. Because what's happened is, if you have called your financial institution, you may or may not have noticed that you don't always get someone, say, even in the United States, answering the phone. Financial institutions have outsourced things as well in terms of back office processing and customer service and things like that. And they are probably even more heavily regulated than higher ed in terms of all of the different parts of the government that are keeping an eye on them, the controller of currencies and treasury and all the different agencies. So they needed to come up with a way of ensuring that when they sent some of these operations out of house, that all of the government entities and auditors were going to be okay with how the third parties were handling their information. And that's what shared assessments was developed for. And it actually feels really good if you're developing your own questionnaire or something like that, that instead of just developing your own questionnaire, you're piggy banking on top of something that was developed by financial institutions and security companies like VeriSign and things like that, because it adds credibility to what you're doing. The other issue with this that sort of is helpful from an industry perspective is, although we aren't necessarily trying to put ourselves in this situation, if you're in the situation of a provider of cloud services or third-party services, every time you have a new customer, they're coming up with a list of questions for you, and you have to answer all those questions. And the questions are always different but similar. So you've got to take somebody's list of questions and figure out if you've ever answered that question before and where the answer is and things like that. So from a service provider's perspective, it's nice from their perspective if they can know that they're getting a standard set of questions. So it's actually a chicken and egg situation where if we could ask things in a standard way, it would benefit them, and it would benefit them if they would do a list of standard questions and answers that they could just give us and just make the whole thing a lot faster from both sides of things. But whether the right way to approach this is all of us say we want the answer to this set of questions, or whether the approach is all of them answer a set of questions and say, here, I hope this is good enough, is sort of unclear. So industry-wise, we're trying to work it from both directions. We have talked to some higher ed service providers and things like that, and tried to get them to get tied into this process as well. Shared assessments, because the financial industry did it, was pretty thorough. It pulls in a whole bunch of different regulations and things like that so that the questions cover issues that are potentially of interest to higher ed. And the output of all of this is a couple of different assessment tools. One is called the SIG, which is an information gathering questionnaire, and the other is agreed upon procedures, which is an audit mechanism or an audit plan. I'm going to focus for the next few minutes on the SIG, and I'm not going to spend too much time on the AUP. And I'll also note, just in passing, that one of the things that's not in here is FERPA, because it was developed for the financial industry. So we'll talk about that again at the end, hopefully. If I don't, feel free to remind me. All right, so the SIG, which is the questionnaire. It's basically an Excel spreadsheet. I'll show you a couple screenshots, which will make you squint and go, geez, in a couple minutes. But essentially, it's tiered. It's got different tabs for different topics. And you can decide how you want to approach it. And also, it maps to all of the different security standards I was talking about in the previous slide. So if you're actually interested in how their questions map to ISO standards or things like that, or COBIT, you can figure out how the questionnaires in the SIG map to standard security frameworks. And you can get it, I should point this out too, at no cost. All you do is you go to sharedassessments.org, you type in an email address and say, I want to register, and they'll let you download it and use it for free. And it's been available for free for a long time. I see no reason to believe that it's not going to be available for free in the future. So we like free things too, right? Boy, it's early in the morning. Or all the vendors have left and you've taken the free things already. So the other thing that's interesting, I'm not going to read the slide to you, is that if you think about it, when the financial industry develops questions, maybe they're a little in-depth, and maybe you don't really want to be the financial industry because we're not the financial industry. And they recognize that that's a problem. There was a version of this a couple versions ago that I think had a couple of thousand questions because every time some new bank or something like that thought of some security question or disaster recovery question or anything else, they throw it on the thing just for thoroughness. So there was actually a question of, like, is there a volcano near your site and things like that, which they've pulled that out, all right? So it's no longer a couple thousand questions, and it is a mature tool. It's been around, as I said, for 10 years. So they're on version 6, and it sort of got to the point that it started out small. It bloated up to the thousands of questions I was talking about, and they've ratcheted it back because people legitimately complained that it had gotten out of control. So it's nice that when you're working on something to know that it's actually had a life cycle and you're sort of picking it up further along in the life cycle and it's a new thing. The Cloud Security Alliance has a questionnaire that looks fine, but it's only been out for like 9 months or something like that. So the full SIG, if you're giving them, you know, social security numbers or credit cards or something like that and you really want to kill yourself, is 700 questions. And most vendors aren't going to want to answer 700 questions, but again, if they get it from everybody and they have the 700 questions answered, they can give it to you. The bigger problem, having gotten some of this, is you don't necessarily want to look at the answers to 700 questions either. So because this is an issue, the shared assessments folks have developed a light questionnaire that cuts it down to about 90 questions. And you can mix and match as well. In version 5, they actually had a medium. So there was light, medium, and heavy. And they took the medium out because they thought that was too confusing. There's some speculation that might go back in. You can see a list of the different areas that the questions cover. If you have a questionnaire or you've thought about dealing with third parties, you may already cover all of these things, and you may not. But it's very thorough. Here's the squint. It's a picture of the questions on the light questionnaire. It's not, the intent here is not for you to read it, but just because I said it was an Excel spreadsheet, that doesn't always mean something to people, so I figured I would just show you what it looks like. So there's a question number, there's a question, there's a column for a response, and you can put in yes, no, or didn't answer. There's a column for notes here. And then there's stuff over on the right here. See where it says reference, ISO reference number, things like that there. So there are columns that go off to the right that have that mapping that I talked about, where it maps to different security frameworks so that you have an understanding of where the question's coming from. And that's the long one. You can see that it looks very similar. You've got item numbers, questions, responses, additional information, mapping, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So It's pretty straightforward. It's an Excel spreadsheet. You can email it to people, or they can download it themselves. They can send it back to you. There is some intelligence built into it, so there's a scoring element where if you actually want to weight the different questions of the 90 questions, it'll automatically do a weighting and give you a sort of a red, green, yellow type score sheet on the first tab of the spreadsheet when you're done. Or it'll tell you there are questions that weren't answered and things like that. So they built in some macros. We had a group from EDUCAUSE that spent about a year looking at these different things and evaluating them. And where we sort of ended up is that we think that the shared assessment SIG is a good thing to use in higher education for the reasons that you see up there. Even if you've got a good questionnaire of your own, it's more defensible if you ever ran into a problem and somebody said, why are you using that vendor and how did you evaluate them and what mechanism did you use, to actually be able to lean on a well-known standard that's used by a bunch of financial institutions and say, we use this financial institution standard as a base and then we asked our own questions and things like that, than to just say, well, we had our best people try to think of the right questions. It's always better to have some sort of a framework you're working for, right? If you haven't developed your own, it's going to save you an awful lot of time, and it's going to get into a level of detail because you're probably not going to get to 700 questions if you're outsourcing something that's particularly important. One of the things that we did in the group is we collected some of the questionnaires from group members, because there were some big research institutions that had developed their own questionnaires, and then we mashed together the shared assessments questions with the questions from institutions where they had developed their own questionnaires and tried to see sort of like what the overlap looked like. And that's what these numbers are with a 50-25-25, okay? So there was about 25% overlap where when institutions developed their own questions, those questions were already on shared assessments. About 50% of the questions on shared assessments didn't appear on any of the current questionnaires that the big institutions had developed. So we were a little bit embarrassed about that. But nonetheless, that's one of the reasons we think it's important to use a tool like this. And finally, and interestingly, just so you don't think I'm selling shared assessments and it's wonderful in every way, shape, and form, 25% of the questions that were asked by the higher ed institutions weren't asked by shared assessments. So it's not going to solve all the world's problems. Like I said, it doesn't ask about FERPA, for example. Nonetheless, if you don't have anything at all that you're doing right now, what this essentially means is you can cover 75% of stuff just by adopting shared assessments outright. Why did I say upright? And then you end up trying to deal with the last quarter of the questions by adding some sort of a supplement. And they recognize that you need supplements. The spreadsheet has a tab that says additional questions. You can add your own questions and things like that. And as I said earlier, it can be a lot of work to go through this. Briefly, the other thing that they provide is this document called the Agreed Upon Procedures. And what the Agreed Upon Procedures are is an auditing framework. Does anybody have, and I know I've talked to some people who do, so that's why I'm curious. Does anybody have a contractual thing that they do when they work with a third party that says, we have the right to audit you? A couple? All right. And has anybody done audits as a result of having that contractual? Okay, we did. So one of the problems that you run into there is if you're going to go audit somebody, how are you going to audit them? Your internal auditors are used to auditing your own organization. They're not used to auditing an external organization. And if you're going to audit some third party, it's nice to tell them what you're going to be doing. So essentially, this AUP is an audit plan. And you can give it to them and say, look, here's what we're going to do. And it says, you need to go in and ask this question and collect this document, ask this question, collect this document for proof to do the audit. And again, it's been agreed upon by the financial institutions and the people they're outsourcing to as a reasonable audit plan. So you've got something to stand on if the person comes back and says, that's unreasonable, I don't want you to do this, it's too much work, what have you. So you can pick that up for free, too, along with the shared assessments. And the AUP maps back to the SIG. So if you use the SIG to ask questions of them and say, did you do this, and do you do this, and do you do this, and then you actually do decide you want to audit them, you can see in their questions in the AUP what you need to do to actually test if they're doing what they said when they answered the questionnaire in the first place. So it's pretty cool. It all ties together in a nice fashion, which makes sense because, as I said, it's a mature standard. So in any case, if you're dealing with third parties, you need to think about contractual issues, and we'll give you a slide at the end. It's still at the end, right? It's not at the end of mine. It's the end of the whole thing. It gives you links to the NACUA and the EDUCOA stuff to get you language around the contractual issues, but you also need to think about asking questions about whether they're doing a good job completely apart from the contract that you're going to sign, and that is something you should adapt or adopt instead of inventing your own. When we did this mapping of whether what we invented ourselves worked, it turned out it didn't really work that good. Only 25% of our questions were in the frameworks. So you want to do all of that stuff. You want to pick some standardized framework. And if you have to pick a framework of the ones we looked at, shared assessment seemed to be best, but feel absolutely free to look at the Cloud Security Alliance or any of the others because they weren't bad and they were certainly better than not doing anything at all or developing your own relatively short questionnaire that might miss things. And now I'll turn it over to Shirley.
Thank you, David. Since we're midway through the presentation, this is probably a good time to remind our online audience to send your questions in. We're going to try to have a little bit of time at the end to do Q&A, but if we run out of time, David and I will be glad to answer the questions from the online audience via email. So at UVA, we are really fortunate in the sense that we have a central IT audit function that is very effective and very helpful to me as a security officer. And so what I want to talk to you about today is an audit finding that was that came out a couple of years ago that addressed this whole issue of third-party agreements. And so as part of that audit, we have developed a couple of tools. We are just starting to use the SIG tool, but these address different aspects of the whole equation. So the audit findings had to do with, basically they found a couple of examples in our departments where departments had outsourced very critical business functions, and they really had not paid attention to any of the security or privacy risk around that. So obviously that's an issue. The other thing in looking at contracts that were signed as a result of that outsourcing, they often found nothing in those contracts that addressed data protection issues. Both audit and my office share the concern that very often we are called in, you know, after something has already been negotiated, and we look at it and say, oh my gosh, there's just, you know, we're sending all this data out and there's nothing here about who's responsible, for example, if there's a data breach. And then from an audit perspective, there was nothing in the contract that addressed how we could, as an institution, assure compliance. In the state of Virginia, there is a state law that says that that an audit of a state or audits within a state agency have a right to audit third parties, but that audit only goes to looking at the financial statements. It doesn't address SAS 70 or, you know, it's the new regulations that are out. So the bottom line is we had a lot of unacceptable risk around the whole issue of third-party agreements. So what we felt we needed to do, we needed to enhance our project-based risk assessment. We were doing some risk assessments, but not a good enough job in this area. Also, we had to preserve our legal right to protect our data and also look at how it's being used. And then we needed to increase the assurance that we could do audit compliance around the whole issue of data protection over the long term. So our first solution, we had two solutions. One was to, as I mentioned, develop a risk assessment tool. This, the University of Virginia has, for a number of years now, had a university-wide IT security risk assessment. And what that does is every department at the institution takes a look at the IT assets that it manages. You know, just like many of you, we have quite a decentralized IT environment, so it's not uncommon at all for a department to have significant IT assets that they manage themselves. So the risk management plan has them every 3 years, or more frequently if their IT environment changes a lot, to do a complete risk assessment, which includes identification of their those critical assets and its connection to their business functions. It does the risk assessment and then goes on to ensure that their mission continuity plans are up to date. And mission continuity plans includes a disaster recovery plan. So we wanted the tool to be a supplement to that, a complement to that. The other thing that I wanted to note is this risk assessment is for all project types. That's how we intend to use it, but especially with our third-party agreement, projects involving third-party agreements. Now, a couple of complexities that we had at the university, we have a major medical center, and they have their own security office. We collaborate very, very closely, but I just wanted to mention it that we needed another party at the table. So that was a little bit, we couldn't just go off and do something because we were really searching for a university-wide solution. Another complication was initially I thought, well, sure, there's got to be a really strong project risk assessment tool out there I can just use. But I really couldn't find one that was going to address the specific issues that we were concerned with. Either they were too lightweight or they were too complicated. I did mention a NIST standard that I like just in terms of how it was framed, but as usual, often a NIST standard is way more than what you might find appropriate. The very first meeting we had of our team to put this tool together, we had the application development manager express concern about, oh gosh, this is just going to be more work on our already overburdened project teams. So we knew that we needed to be very careful to keep this tool contained, not add to work unnecessarily. So what you see here, I won't go into this in detail, but our tool is going to address these specific components, and I'll touch on them very lightly. First step, we want to know up front, is any sort of outsourcing planned? As I mentioned earlier, we're going to use this for all projects, not just those that will have third-party agreements. But I want to know up front what we're dealing with, is any of that contemplated? The second thing is I want to know what sort of data will be addressed and handled by the project. Like many institutions, we have defined data classifications. We have three. And so I want to know early on, you know, what category of data that we're talking about. At UVA, we have some fairly strict data protection standards for each classification of data. So we call that, they're strict, but then they're also a baseline. There may be other things that will be needed. So the tool will bring that information out. The next step is describing the data access requirements. And here I'm talking about things like authentication and authorization requirements. And then the fourth is actually looking at the data risk assessment and again, it's going back to those baseline data security requirements and determining, are those enough or do we need more? We also have the next step is looking at the security architecture plan. Again, our network folks, for example, is another group that often finds out like a month before it needs to be ready that this group is going to need, you know, the project is going to need a highly secured server. So we want to get those conversations going early on. The describing the audit strategy, this is very important for our IT audit group, obviously. They want to have a conversation about what sort of audit controls are being built in and designed into the project so that it can help them think about what how they're going to audit this whole, whatever the deliverable is from the project. And then the seventh item is getting a categorization of the deliverable. And what I mean by that, is this going to be a mission-critical function? And that's important for the final step, which is deciding how the department's mission continuity plan needs to change. This is another thing that came out in the audit that was done, that in looking at the mission continuity plans for some of the departments, although they had outsourced this major business function, they had not adjusted their mission continuity plans for that. So those are the eight steps in the risk assessment tool. The second solution that we came up with is to develop a standard contractual language tool that we are using now for third-party agreements in which a third party is going to be handling sensitive institutional data. It's informed by this great contractual tool that David has already mentioned. It's EDUCAUSE resource, and we have a link to it at the end. That is, as I said, a wonderful tool. For various reasons, we are leveraging that in what we put together, but we felt we needed something specific in our area. The other thing is we are leveraging the NACWA CSG Shared Services Work Group model contract. I think David also mentioned that. We were extremely fortunate in that one of our attorneys in our general counsel office is served on that working group. So she had already had a lot of dialogue with colleagues at other institutions working on this team about what sort of contractual language do we need for third parties. Again, some complexities. I mentioned already the two security offices, but also we have two different procurement offices, one in the medical center and one on the academic side. We also needed to ensure that what we put together was very much in sync with our business associates agreements that we've already been doing for years with where data that is subject to HIPAA is involved. And then also we had to accommodate our grant contractual obligations as well, making sure that we kept those in mind. And then the last thing, we knew that we were going to, based on experience, that we would run into some resistance in terms of on-site audit reviews. So we wanted to address some language in there that would provide some alternatives. So our contractual language tool is, it's basically, obviously our procurement office already had their baseline T's and C's to address other issues like indemnification. So this was an extension of that. I also wanted to mention that although we didn't start this way, where we are right now is we are also using the contractual language for all of our procurements, even though those that don't involve a contract, a unique contract. So if we have a vendor who's in our accepted vendor list, to be on that list, they have to basically sign this agreement up front. So we are, the way we're going to be using this tool is we realize that we have to be flexible in it because every procurement is a little bit different. So we are not setting it up so you have to have every single one of these things in a contract. Also, maybe you need a particular section in the contract, but the wording isn't quite right. So that's allowable as well. And then the other thing is it's not a substitute for consultation. So as a security officer, I get so excited when somebody calls me and says, I'm putting together an RFP, and hey, what kind of contractual language do I need in it? And so just because we now have the standard doesn't mean that they can't still call me, or I would not want them to call me to consult about that. And the auditors would say the same thing. So I won't go through all of these, but I just wanted you to see the kinds of issues that we are developing in or we have included in our contracts. It was interesting, certainly not on the level of the thousands of questions for SIG, but we did start with a larger number, and as we've worked together, we've winnowed it down. So just to put these tools in context with what David has talked about, in thinking about data risk associated with third-party agreements, our tool, our project risk assessment, will be addressing that issue just as the project is getting started. The vendor risk assessment, we do intend to use the SIG. Again, you know, we're just starting that, so we'll see how well it goes. But we're going to use the SIG for vendor risk assessments. And then on the back end, we have our set of contractual provisions that we are going to be including as a starting point in all of our RFPs because we really want to start our contract negotiations based from our perspective rather than to take something that a vendor provides and make adjustments for that. So for us, this approach we thought was successful and doable, and you know, some of our success factors really had to do with this cross-disciplinary task force. One of the real benefits that came out of this is that we had these people from these areas at the table, and it's very interesting that with the contractual tool that was developed to get two different procurement offices at the table. We had two attorneys as well, audit. To sit down and work through this together has been a wonderful learning experience for each of us. I've learned more about procurement. Although I've done procurements for years, I've learned more to see it now from their eyes. They've learned a lot about data protection concerns, and the attorneys have learned as well, and we've learned from them. Also, as I said, we've leveraged the national level resources as well, and I think the more we can do that, the better. Because the more we speak from one voice, the more vendors will listen. And I think from a vendor's perspective, I would think that they would prefer that as well. And then finally, you know, we really, this was a well-understood need It was hard to argue, first off, hard to argue with audit findings, also, well, you may want to, but anyway, these were very clear why we needed to have this. I guess the other thing, too, is I think it's so important for us to be in a position where we can take this opportunity for cloud computing and more outsourcing third-party agreements. We really, you know, there are so many good opportunities in that regard. So by having these tools, by doing our due diligence, we can be better consumers of those arrangements. So here's the resources that we talked about, and do we have some time for a Q&A? We've got 4 minutes. Oh, and also we need to ask you to use the microphone, if you will, for our... Okay.
Very quickly, I appreciate the audit process, and I know our auditors at PricewaterhouseCoopers are using that same outsourcing risk assessment. But what has been the vendor response when at both your institutions, when you approach the vendors and all of a sudden present them with this more substantial or risk assessment where you need particularly the contractual language to protect the data?
So you want to respond from the SIC, since I'm just starting?
It's a good question. It varies. There are some who actually already have it, and it's good. So there's a portion of SunGuard that has it. There's a portion of Iron Mountain that has it. Higher One has already done it. So some of them are like, phew. Some of them are like, this is horrible. But because it's a standardized tool, and you can like point them off to independent websites and things like that that show that people are using it, they usually sort of come around.
And from the contractual provisions, although we've just finished the tool, we've been using it, you know, pieces of it all along, and I've been really pleasantly surprised at how accepting of these terms the vendors that we've dealt with have been. We have just gotten a response from a key vendor I was concerned about, but they accepted almost everything. I think the area that we are still getting a little more, I'd say, concern from vendors is some of the audit provisions that we have in there.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there's been any discussion of sharing not just the framework, but perhaps some of the results, rather than talking with the vendors, having a way where some of the data itself, like things that are stronger or weaker at different vendors, could be shared?
Yes. That isn't going to happen. So let me tell you why and what is going to happen instead. Okay? Because the questionnaire has like 700 detailed security questions, vendors don't want those results to be shared or public or anything like that. So the shared assessments people are in the process of, if they don't already have, you'd have to look around on their website. I haven't looked recently. Trying to make a list of vendors who have the questionnaire and will provide it to someone they're legitimately engaged in some sort of a start of a relationship with. But sort of like PCI, I understand why you want it. But it sort of kills me that we can't have it, but just like people don't publish their PCI things and what their compensating controls are for things that they didn't do and stuff, it's just not going to get published.
Hi, David. Do you think a university could self-assess using the SIG and then use that to compare with a third-party service response and see where benefits can be found?
That's a great question. I forgot to mention that. There are people who have heard about this and said, if we're trying to figure out how to assess the maturity of our security department or where we need to do things, can we do it to ourselves? And the answer is yes, it works fine to do it to yourself.
I would just add, for the question of the vendors, that was the previous question, as a vendor who's worked with the University of Virginia, we welcome this, and it's very refreshing, because a lot of times we're pushing to make sure that, you know, data is protection, and you want to work with a vendor who is going to embrace this and want to give you the answers, because they should want you to know that they have your best interest at heart. So I would just say to anybody in the room who has any pause about presenting this to a vendor, don't. And if you get any pushback, that's not a wonderful partnership. And I think you, as vendors, we want to have a wonderful partnership with each of the colleges and universities that we work with. So I'm very appreciative of everything that's been put together for this, and I think it's a wonderful model.
Thank you, Kelly. That was a very good perspective. Okay. I think we're out of time.
I think we're about out of time. I think the next session is the general session at 10:45, which gives you a little time to get all the way to the other end of things, but we'll be here for a couple minutes if anybody has anything.